My name is Eric Michaud. I'm a third-year PhD student in the Department of Physics at MIT. Thank you, Anandita, for hosting me. It's been a fun visit. This is also a nice room, very cozy. So I'll be talking today about this paper that I worked on earlier this year, the quantization model of neural scaling, which has been accepted at NeurIPS now. And you know, there might be kind of different levels of background in machine learning in the room. Let's first just like talk about some background on language models, scaling laws and emergence, sort of the core things I'll be wrestling with in the talk and in the paper. And I think so, especially in this section, but also just like throughout the whole thing, it'd be great if people like interrupted with questions to really understand what's going on here. So first, what do language models do? So language models like ChatGPT, right, are first trained to like predict what comes next in text. The first thing that happens, you know, given some text, right, is you decompose it into tokens according to some vocabulary. So the tokens might be, you know, about like words, but they could also be individual characters. Lots of different ways to tokenize text. And then the goal is, you know, that language models are sort of tasked with is just like predicting the next token representing some text that follows some other text, right? So once you have a, yeah, go ahead.
What's some reason why the word Z is given two different numerical IDs?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, so it's because this token is just the word the, and it's also capitalized, and then this actually has a space bar at the beginning of the token, and then the word the. So this is like just a quirk of the way that text is tokenized is that if you imagine like tokenizing a bunch of English text and there's space bars everywhere, if you had a space bar dedicated token that was used, like if the way you tokenize each words did not include the space bar, then every other token like would be a space bar, and then like the sequences would be twice as long. So it's kind of like efficient if you have a large enough vocabulary to include the space bar, like include the space in a bunch of the tokens. And this is like a quirk where for a while, like when you were interacting with like the OpenAI API with some of the earlier language models, they would like suggest that like you don't end your prompt on a space bar. And that way, like the next token that the model can predict will be like a word that contains the space bar. But anyway, what the models do, yeah?
Another question. I'm thinking about this in the context of Hamming coding. I would expect space bar Z to be a common. Mm.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think actually the 15 is representing the period at the end of the sentence. I don't know like exactly how the numerical IDs are determined. Yeah. The basic idea is like we have just a vocabulary of tokens which we can use to sort of like discretize text, and then like you know a common like number of tokens in a vocabulary might be like 50,000, and so basically what the model is going to output at each like position in the sequence is a probability distribution over 50,000 elements for what the next token will be in the sentence. This is what the models are trained on. Yeah, so I think if you look at like what are the very early ones, it's like punctuation and this kind of thing, which like just does occur more often.
Yeah, okay, but not 252 different punctuation
laws.
Maybe
it doesn't. Yeah, but like, so like texts can be surprising, especially texts like across all of the internet, and like there can be there are just like a lot of so for instance. Like English words might be assigned their own token, or like spacebar English word might be assigned its own token, but like maybe words in other languages have to be split up into like like much shorter tokens, and like yeah, it just happens to be the case that like.
I don't see why what happens with other languages is any relevance to how you code up English.
I'm just saying that like if you look at like it's not entirely surprising to me that the word like that spacebar lowercase the is like if these IDs correspond to the frequency. That like that would be the 253rd. Like that seems about right to me.
Okay. Well, I'm unconvinced.
That's okay. So anyway, we can assign just like a numerical value to like the performance of the model at each position in terms of like how well it's sort of like predicting the next token, which is maybe just like the log of the probability that it assigned to the actual token that occurred next. So like the model minimizes its loss when it like. Assigns very high probability to the token that actually occurs next. Okay. There's this incredible kind of like regularity though to the average loss that the models achieve as a function of their scale. So the number of parameters that they have internally and the number of data points that they were trained on. So here I'm showing some studies from Jared Kaplan and Sam McElvish and all and others, and this is a study from OpenAI. And basically, in each of these plots, we have some measure of the resources used to train the model on the x-axis, like the number of, you know, roughly the number of parameters in the model, or the size of the data set that the model was trained on. So like how many tokens were contained in all of the documents across which the model was trained to do prediction on. And we just see that there's this kind of power law. So on a log-log plot, the mean loss drops off as a power law, as a function of parameters, data set size. You can also do this roughly for the compute used to train the model, where roughly the compute is the number of parameters times the number of data points. And we see this power law kind of holds sort of here the envelope of these curves for compute across many orders of magnitude. And this is like a very important fact about these systems, partially because it's like what justifies spending tens of millions of dollars to train the next model if you can be confident that this, the performance will be predictable and that like there will be gains from doing that.
Just like intuitively then, like to interpret the test loss here, what is the difference in loss between like a good model and a bad model?
So like a model that we would say is like subjectively impressive if we interacted with it versus.
Yeah, sure. Is it like?
Yeah.
Is it, I can't really put an interpretation to the y-axis.
Yeah, so I think this is the, it's the cross entropy in NATs. So like I think a one NAT loss would correspond to like on average the distribution, like if it was a uniform distribution that the model was predicting, would be spread across like 2.7 tokens or something. There's actually, and I'll get into this later, but there's this kind of this, like wide distribution in practice of like how uncertain the model is depending on like which token it's predicting. Where like some tokens, like you can be very confident in predicting, like in text, and then like others, it's just like much less certain. So like this, yeah, and this is like a really important point is that these like are scaling in like the mean loss, like averaged across like a large number of tokens across a large number of documents. And then in terms of like how good the model is complicated. And like this is actually part of the motivation for what I'll be talking about today, is that like sometimes even while the sort of overall loss is like smooth and predictable, like maybe once you like cross certain thresholds in the average, there can be these kind of jumps in like qualitatively the capabilities of the model. So just to discuss a little bit of some prior work about like what has been done to explain these scaling laws. One just like very clean explanation, or at least very simple explanation, is that these power laws are what you would expect if the model was doing some basic function approximation. So just in general, if you have some function from RD to R and you're approximating it with like a piecewise linear function, so you're sort of like breaking up the like input space into a bunch of pieces and then approximating that function as linear on each piece. Then like as you increase the density of those linear regions, assuming some things about the function, then like you you can derive that like you know, as density gets greater, that the loss error drops off as a power law. So this is kind of a nice picture of scaling as just like globally increasing the precision at which the function is being approximated as this kind of smooth process of better and better approximating something. But there are these kind of interesting phenomena in deep learning where this view of thinking about the process of training for longer or training a bigger model on more data doesn't feel so smooth. So here I'm training just a small transformer model on a couple of different tasks where there's this more like discreteness in what's going on during training, where over time, as I train for longer, the loss might actually kind of plateau at a certain point, and then at some other point drop. This is for this task sparse parity, which I'll talk more about later. This one's a little bit easier to describe. I just tasked a small neural network with classifying whether a given string was a palindrome or not. And you see these kind of transitions or something. Machine learning people call these like you know, phase changes or phase transitions, and then physicists get upset about this. Yeah, it feels like there's a kind of like discreteness here where on certain types of problems where maybe the network has to learn some algorithm, it feels less like this kind of smooth process of better and better approximating something and more like there's this eureka moment. Although I don't fully understand really what's going on internally in the networks during these. And actually for this task, you can, I think, define, there was this paper from Ben Edelman and Buzz Brock at Harvard defining like notions of progress measures where you maybe could have anticipated this was coming if you could look inside the network. Yep.
Did you anticipate that the training and the testing loss pretty much followed the same curve?
Yeah, I guess that is kind of interesting about these tasks is that like the network doesn't really overfit. Although actually, now that I think about it, I think like the data sets were like potentially kind of large here where it would have been hard for the model to memorize, and so maybe it's like not surprising that like the test and the train are about the same.
It also
Let's start with Ellie.
Well, the number of steps that you're talking here, you're not, I don't know what kind of like many batches you use. So is it possible that some part of the data that it hasn't seen up until that step, then it sees it and says, oh, I see, I have to retrain the network in this way, so therefore the loss function completely decreases. Maybe they had like...
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Have you trained this like with different shufflings of data?
Yeah, it seems, particularly for this task, which I'll describe in detail, it seems like that's maybe not quite what's going on, where it's like, oh yeah, like it just sees some new examples which like allow it to figure something else out. It might be that like each of the batches like roughly like give the same signal to the model. But it's an interesting point. Yeah. Cool. And so those were for really small models, which I was just training, but this kind of like transition has been like observed in actual language models while they're being trained, for instance. So this is a paper from Anthropic called In-Context Learning and Induction Heads, where they found that this kind of particular capability of the model to sort of like copy text from earlier in the context and then like continue subsequences which occurred earlier kind of appears at a certain point in training, and it coincides with this formation of this particular structure in the model called an induction head, which they like have a mechanistic understanding sort of like how it works. So it seems here like there's this nice picture of this kind of particular structure that they can like look at in the network forming at a certain time, and then like this ability also kind of emerging at the same time in the model. So that's over training, but you can also look at things that look sort of emergent is the term that people use while scaling like the size of the network, right? So Earlier we saw that the mean loss is really smooth as a power law, but when you look at like particular capabilities of the model, like whether it can do three-digit addition or do program synthesis or something, if you plot that some measure of performance on particular tasks against scale, so here they're training bigger and bigger networks, you can sometimes see these jumps where it seems like the quantitative, you know, change in the number of parameters leads to this qualitative change in like what the network is capable of on particular things. And yeah, people do use the term emergence or like emergent abilities to describe this. And like the kind of lineage of that term, like in like these papers about this, like it does eventually, you know, date back to P.W. Anderson, and it's like, well, more is different, more parameters, different capabilities of the model. This is kind of controversial because you can look at like other ways of measuring the model's performance on these specific things, like the probability, like track the probability of the correct answer, and it seems like that does like more gradually increase. So it's kind of confusing, and there's still like debate and discussion going on about this right now. But just interacting with the models, like interacting with GPT-4 over GPT-3. One of the things that they showed off when they announced GPT-4 was that like you could ask the model to write a sentence with all of the words starting with the same letter, and the model was like pretty good at this, and it's something that like earlier systems couldn't do. So it's tempting to think about like GPT-4 as like having some algorithm internally for doing this, which is just qualitatively not present in GPT-3, but we don't know.
The argument estimates converge for like very small models.
Oh yeah, I guess sometimes if you look at things on a linear scale, it'll look like it's converged, and then if you like look at things on a log scale, it looks like it's still making progress. But like to make a little bit more progress, you would need to go for, you know, orders of magnitude longer.
This is for like a fixed number.
Oh, good question about these plots. Yeah, I was just talking about it in general, but yeah, for language models, I actually don't know. So I guess with GPT-3. So I guess this is the family of models released with GPT-3. It's possible what they were doing here was not necessarily training to convergence, but like training in the like compute optimal way. Basically, like you know, earlier I showed these like scaling curves where we're just scaling one at a time, but you can also talk about like the joint relationship between like parameters and data and how loss depends on each, and then like in this plane, there's like an optimal place to be from a compute standpoint. So they might have been training in a compute optimal way, but I'm not sure. OK, so there's maybe some tension here. The loss overall is like smoothly decreasing, but then particular capabilities of the model seem to sort of arise at particular scales. And so just in general, you know, how should we think about how scaling changes what neural networks learn and how they're composed? And our sort of key idea and result here is just that smooth scaling curves can average over lots of sort of discrete changes in the scales of the model. So first, I'll just do a demonstration of this fact with some toy data sets, and then we'll talk about language models. So here's this interesting task, this toy task, called multitask sparse parity. And it's just a binary classification problem on binary strings. And the idea is, with sparse parity, that like the model is supposed to compute the parity of a subset of bits in the input. So the way this is multitask is that we have some bits in the input, which we call the task bits. Then there are other bits in the input strings, which are called the control bits. And then which control bit is on tells the network which subset of the task bits it's supposed to compute the parity of. And these are sort of assigned randomly before we start training. And then they're fixed. So for instance, like in this example, if like the third control bit is on, then the network is supposed to compute the parity of like this bit, and this bit. And like if a different control bit is on, it's supposed to compute the parity of a different subset, where the parity is just the sum mod 2 of the bits. And you see when you train networks on this. So here I'll just be training a small, it's not even a transformer, like a language model. It's just a small NLP with one hidden layer and ReLU activation. And you see that the process of training the network, here I'm showing the mean loss in green. And then these other curves look really interesting and sort of non-convex. I should actually define something. So here I sort of talk about different subtasks in the problem. A subtask is just like data where a particular control bit is on. So like input strings where the first control bit is on or subtask one, and input strings where the second control bit is on is subtask two, and so on.
Can you have multiple subtasks on at the same time or no?
Yeah, maybe there are ways that you could set that up, but for this, I just said that only one control bit was ever on at a time.
Is each subtask a different binary function?
So each subtask is like the network is supposed to compute the parity of a different subset of the task bits in the input string. Yeah.
Is the number of like the size of that subset fixed? Like here, it looks like it's always 3 bits. Every single subtask?
It's fixed for every single subtask. And so here we used three.
You could define it differently if you wanted, but.
Yeah, you could define it differently if you wanted. There's kind of like a general region where like it's tractable, because like if you have like very long input strings and like very and you're computing the parity of like maybe a very large number of them, then like there's this kind of like scaling and like the number of steps you need and this kind of thing to learn it. So three is like just like a scale that we can do experiments on easily. And so just like what's going on in this plot, right, is that, and one last thing about these data sets is that they're not like, some control bits are on more frequently than others. And basically what I've done is I've imposed a power law distribution over how frequently each subtask occurs, how frequently each control bit is on. Right, so like the first control bit is on the most, and then the second control bit is on less and less and less and less, and then like these frequencies follow power law. And then when you do this, you just see that this sort of mean loss, averaging across like the whole data set, averages over a bunch of these sort of transitions where the network goes from like having like random guess accuracy, like one bit of cross entropy, down to zero. And so the sort of mean overall kind of scaling of loss averages over a bunch of these discrete changes in the capabilities of the models of the model on different subsets of the data.
Oh, can I ask a very basic question?
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the data set, the data set does not really seem representative for a lot of machine learning tasks. To me, as someone who has no idea what's going on, it seems like a task where the neural network would learn through memorization instead of through generalization. So because there are very specific patterns, so it's like training examples that match exactly that pattern. So there is no, so I do not.
It's a little.
Or a network would interpolate or extrapolate or something. It's like to generalize from something that is learned.
Yeah, so I think it's probably not quite right to think about it as memorizing. So here, by the way, I am showing like test loss. So these are on like strings which the network hasn't seen before. And the reason why I can be pretty confident that it hasn't seen it before is that like, in this figure, like it's not like exactly what we did in the paper. Like in the paper, the task bits were longer. So it was like 50 or 100 task bits. And so there are like 2 to the 50 or 2 to the 100 at least. Different, like if there's only one subtask, there would be 2 to the 50 or 2 to the 100, depending on whether I use 50 or 100, different like input strings. And so then it would just be very unlikely that like the network would see the same one twice. I was like 2 to the 15 is 2 to the 50 is 10 to the 15 about.
That's a very large number.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand what you mean, but in principle, the task is for each control bit, the network just needs to learn A, what qubits not to look at, and then B compared to not the qubits.
Yeah.
So it's like not look at 12 indices and compare 3 indices.
Yeah.
Generalizing.
I mean, the generalizing would be in the not look at a lot of other strings. So yeah, you're right. It would be generalizing, but yeah, you're right. It's generalizing, but it's a weird generalization because
yeah.
The generalization is basically in the part that the neural network should not use, right?
I mean, the two parts, that and adding them together, but you're saying you're adding them together because they're very small, like they're only two
yeah.
bits, and might just memorize them?
Yeah, I think that actually is what, I think that is what happens. So one hint there is that if you look at some of the much like less frequent subtasks, the ones that are learned much later, like barely learned in this training run, some of them don't actually drop like all the way to zero, but we see something like, bummer. If we catch it, we have to be quick. So one of these curves, it's going to clearly plateau at like a kind of halfway point here and then drop. So like there. And I think actually what's going on is that there are like 8 sub-subtasks here corresponding to 2^3, where like the network learns some feature or something which activates when each possible combination of the 3 bits is on. So there's a kind of like, it's more complicated than just memorization, but I think like your intuition is like kind of right that it's not necessarily learning for each subtask a like unified algorithm for like computing the parity, but rather like features which like activate are sort of specific to like the sort of the subset of possible like strings that the subset of bits that we care about can take. So
you probably do yeah. some sort of a PCA on one of the layers, like more, like close to the output layer, and see if their distances between those like 3 different bits is like, are they close to each other or are they like far apart in the space? And if they're like far apart, then it's I think that looks like a memorization thing. But if they're like close, then it found like some sort of like if you have
yeah.
to say 100 and also 001, and those have like some sort of like I mean they're both 1.
Uh huh.
And if they're closer to each other than 011, let's say.
Uh huh.
Then that would mean that something like it has also learned like a.
Yeah.
As opposed to just memorizing them.
You might just expect that in general, though, if like, you know, if the network is going to be classifying like 2 activation vectors like as ultimately the same thing, that like one way that it could do that is to just like put them close together in activation space or something. So this might be what you would expect no matter what.
Maybe, I mean.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. This
sort of like dynamics reproducible if you just switch the labeling of which is which subtask, right? Because you have this power law distribution of which ones you choose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that's, you know, obviously the first ones, it learns like the ones that are more sort of common to be drawn in the data set learns first.
Yeah.
I assume that persists if you just switch the labeling and it's not just that like these ones are easier or something. Like, I don't know. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Just due to the power law of distribution.
I think there's some randomness where, like, this was actually recently studied in this other paper from the people at Harvard I mentioned earlier, Ben Edelman and Boaz Barak, where, there can be an element of luck where if the network is sort of, like, initialized, like, it can be like lucky subnetworks present at initialization, which are already like closer to like the thing that the network needs to learn for each one. And so what, like this is not exactly in order maybe, but it's like roughly in order.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's just over training, but then let's also talk about scaling the size of the network and then also training on different amounts of data. So here we're earlier we were showing basically what was going on in the middle column here, where like the mean loss decreases over the number of steps in training, and then what I'm showing at the bottom is the network's loss on each subtask. Where here, dark means it's getting about 0 loss. And we see that like this mean loss decreasing nicely is sort of averaging over this process where a bunch of the network's performance on different subtasks kind of transitions from loss of one to a loss of zero over time. But this is also the case for parameters and training data. So as we scale the size of the network here, just increasing the width of the network, we plot the mean loss there. It's roughly a power law, a little less clean. And then there's this kind of frontier of like things which we either do or don't learn. And the effect of increasing the size of the network is to get zero loss on more and more subtasks. We're here. People might not actually be able to see this one, but like the network first gets like approximately zero loss on like the most frequently occurring subtasks, which is what it should do. If it can only learn one, it should learn the most frequently occurring one, because that's how you reduce the loss the most. And then the effect of scaling is to learn the more and more niche ones. And this is also roughly what's going on with data scaling as well. Yep.
Sorry, just on that first one where you're scaling the number of parameters.
Yep.
There's some points as you go, like I choose one subtask and you go across horizontally.
Yeah.
Where it looks like it drops to zero and then it comes back up. Like these like individual pixels that are black in the yellow region.
Yeah.
Can you explain what's happening there?
I don't really understand what's happening there. I guess with each of these networks, there's a different initialization because they're all different sizes. And some like element of like luck in your initialization could lead you to like have an easier time learning some than others. Yeah. I also don't really know what's going on here. Like, why is it that this subtask was like learned for most of the networks like earlier than like it should have been? Maybe that was just random. Yeah.
This is maybe not like well phrased, but how many parameters do you think you need to represent like the actual Boolean circuit that performs this task correctly?
Compressed version, like if you were to write it yourself, sort of thing.
Or right, like I think, write out the matrix for the set of Tefali gates or whatever. And like, how sparse is that matrix?
I think. I think maybe like you could ask how many neurons, like how many hidden layer neurons do you need for a given subtask? And I think it's pretty low. So like you could maybe learn a subtask if you knew exactly how to set the parameters right. You're doing it yourself, like with a very small number of neurons, like maybe just a few, maybe less. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. I mean you can of course write down. So you need one control neuron and two neurons for each subtask. So it's like you sum up, so just the sum of all inputs where all weights are zero connected to non-relevant qubits, and plus the sum weighted with one, if it's higher than a certain threshold, your weight, then the neuron gets activated. The same thing for if all these three are zero, so you need two, and then one control neuron, and then you would need the second layer. But that just means you need, so the minimal architecture that I can come up with, three neurons in one layer for each subtask, and then maybe another hidden layer that combines it to an output.
Thousands of parameters?
What?
Is that like thousands of parameters then?
So the tricky thing, so the I had it here, I guess it was like 500 subtasks or something. So there are actually 500 control bits, and then there's like maybe 50 or 100 task bits. So it's like 550 or 600 input dimension. And then I think I went up to like, I don't know, high hundreds, maybe low thousands number of neurons in the hidden layer. But if you imagine like each neuron that you add has connections to like 500 or 600 like of the inputs, and then also then just has a couple connections to the outputs. So anyway, each neuron that you add adds like at least 500 parameters to the model.
A lot of parameters.
Okay, but I think I think what is crucial is when it performs this learning task, one natural solution would be that almost all of these weights get set to zero when it just So when it learns not to look at specific parts of the bit string, then it can set all these weights to zero.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's possible to like construct a network which is like very sparse, which like solves each of these subtasks. In practice, like I don't think I was training with any regularization, so like it's possible that like it wasn't ever incentivized to be sparse, and so it might not actually in practice be sparse.
This is just like a feed-forward network.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interestingly, it's actually kind of hard to get transformers to learn the multitask version of this task when there are lots of tasks. This might have to do with something like related to, like you need to figure out like exactly which bits to use or whatever when you compute the parity, and like the only time that information is ever like shared across sequence positions in the transformer, so here each bit is its own token, is like in the self-attention layer, and like yeah, it just might be really hard for like the architecture to like it has to be this like explicit like moving around of information between sequence positions in the self-attention layer. It might be hard.
Like your control bit is like all day on the left of the string. It's like 500 zeros between that and like the target bits. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much like the distance that matters, but like maybe because like the transformer is sort of like agnostic about or I mean, it depends maybe a little bit on the architecture you're using, but like in just a normal dense like self-attention layer, like the sequence positions are sort of like treated equally, where it's like,
oh, true.
Yeah.
Why would that be hard? Why would it be hard? Like, and also, if it doesn't matter what the distance between them is, like let's say you have a one here, one here, 500 zeros between them.
Yeah.
I thought transformers should be like actually specifically good at that, shouldn't they?
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah, I don't really understand why it's hard, I guess like ultimately the network maybe needs to like get the information about like the exact like you can't solve the task at all if you don't know exactly which sort of subset of the bits you need to be computing the parity from, and so there's this, you know, just difficult challenge in general of, like okay, figuring out exactly which ones, and then like I don't know, like with the MLP, like every neuron in the hidden layer is connected to everything in the input, so like by default. And then like with the transformer, though, like the self-attention mechanism, like the like it might be hard, or like maybe the default in the attention patterns that you get in the attention layer would be.
If you had a sentence that the next word only depends on like two particular words, everything else is just absolute crap.
Yeah, and they can kind of do that.
Would transformer fail in predicting the next word if the sentence is like that? If some like very skillful writer wrote a sentence like in a very weird way?
Yeah, I don't know, because I see your point. Like, it seems like a thing that the transformers like can do pretty well is like retrieve information from the context. So yeah, I don't know exactly why it's hard for them to do it on this task. Okay, so anyway, just to describe a model for I think like what's roughly going on, like in terms of the scaling here in the parity tasks. So we call this like the quantization model, because we're basically saying that there are a bunch of these kind of discrete things which the network has to learn how to do, these different skills. So it's like it needs to figure out how to perform well in each subtask. We're going to call these like the quanta of the prediction problem. Then we're going to say that, well, because of how frequently each subtask occurs and there being a difference where some subtasks occur more frequently than others, then ability to do some subtasks is more useful for lowering the mean loss than others. So if you can only like learn how to do like one subtask, you should do the most frequently occurring one, the first one. So this is kind of natural like sequence. Of like, if you can only learn so many things, you should learn the early ones in the sequence. Here, just ordered by the frequency. And you know, we impose this power law frequency distribution. And just to say this, like, I don't know, quantization. Kind of using it informally here. Unfortunately, it also means something else in machine learning, having to do with like floating point quantization. But here, we're just talking about it as like some discreteness in like. What needs to be learned by the network. So it's like, oh yeah, like Maybe a while ago, Planck solved, you know, the ultra catastrophe problem by assuming that energy was sort of discretized into chunks, you know, energy quanta. And then here we're going to say that like the knowledge of the network is quantized. Yep.
Is there some systematic philosophy for how you chunk things? I'm thinking, you know, maybe this is something you introduce a notion of locality, right? So when you chunk bits instead of just arbitrary pulling bits from all over the place, which you would expect to not be correlated, instead grab chunks that are somehow, for some sense, distant, close to each other, right? Certainly if you're doing a language model, I would expect that to be a good domain.
Close together in the input?
Mm-hmm. You have screens of text.
Yeah.
Right? You feed that to the system, you want to chunk it. Right? If I sort of open the book, like, I don't know, War and Peace, and I pick one word from page 4, or one word from page 20, or one from page 300, or one page from 468, or however long that book is, I would not expect to see much correlation between those words.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if I just take the first sentence of a paragraph, I would expect, you know, they would at least hang together in terms of logic. I'm talking about how cold it is.
I can imagine a function that can map all of the random words from different pages, where you can make a complicated enough function that brings those close to each other and everything else further apart. So like page 4 would be very close to 320 in space of the mapping from a particular function, but 4 and 5 are very far away. So I think a logical neural network can...
That would make much sense if you think about pages from a book.
Yeah. I can write down such a thing if I really wanted to, but if you want to actually solve the problem that you're trying to do with large language models, it's not going to help you. Might be a nice method for constructing your password for your laptop, right? Nice, uncorrelated words. You see the XKCD talking about how to make a good password. That might be a good way of doing it. But if what you want to do is predict text, I think it's not
going to help you. Right. Plus the kind of function that you were talking about that might give rise to hallucinations, quote-unquote, because then it would just try to correlate two different phrases or ideas together that simply do not go together. We don't want, and through the process of training, we don't want to generalize to the case where the LLM is hallucinating.
Yeah,
it's
kind of like an overfitting thing.
Yeah, so I'll talk later about like the kinds of things that might be like the quanta in language modeling. I don't necessarily think about these as necessarily requiring for the relevant inputs to be close together in the input, but rather like for language, there is just a large number of things that you need to learn to do prediction well, like a large number of pieces of knowledge, and also knowledge sort of about how to do different computations, because like language reflects the world, and the world is very diverse and complicated, and there are like lots of pieces of knowledge or computations that went into producing text. And so in order to like predict it, we might need the model to like learn these pieces of knowledge or pieces of computation in order to predict text.
So to connect to the question that you raised, to say the definition for a proper distance norm in the case of languages is not very well defined or intuitive. So not as taking the difference between what's in the different pages.
Yeah, there's a you can study, for instance, like how does the performance of the model on average improve if it has more and more context to use to predict what the next token is going to be. And I think I've seen this, and it's like roughly a power law, maybe, but I might be misremembering. But basically, like as you give the model more and more context, of like what came before, then like it's better and better able to predict what the next word is.
Yeah, but context is also a big notion. I was just wondering if there is a bigger quantity notion to define how much information content there needs to be to define it as a context. How much correlation there needs to be between two different phrases to say that the LLM can learn something from this.
Yeah, I think it depends on the token that you're trying to predict. And sometimes you can like eliminate most of the context and it's still able to predict it like really well. So like lots of short phrases like are really recognizable, and like you can get rid of everything up until the beginning of the phrase, and then so it's like it only needs one or two tokens maybe of context, but then other things require like information across a large amount of context.
I see.
Yeah.
I'm a physicist rather than a computer scientist, but I mean, the kind of intuition that I'm working on here is the concept of matrix product states, where you can compress things quite efficiently by learning what stuff you can ignore, right? And so for an example, if you're dealing with text, humans use cliches a lot, right? So if you see the phrase once upon a, right, the next word is almost certainly time. And that will work as a template a lot of the time. Unless you're dealing with somebody who likes to trip you up. So I could also say once upon a hangover, right? It makes perfect sense. A lot of us can probably imagine that situation, but it's not the cliche, and it can throw the algorithm if it's expecting the word time.
Yeah, it would get very, very high loss because it was like, yeah.
Right. But if you're trying to produce a matrix product state situation, you don't care about the second example because it's extraordinarily rare, right? And so you would just expect your system to learn the phrase once upon a time.
Yeah.
And then recognize that. And if it fails every once in a blue moon because like somebody's being awkward, like me, well, don't worry about it, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'm a member of the awkward squad.
Yeah. It might be that, like, some of the time, if someone was going to say something awkward like that, you might get hints of it earlier in the context. And so, like, maybe a very big model might, like, learn something about the kinds of things that indicate that, like, this, the narrator, you know, the, whoever wrote the text is unpredictable. And then they would...
The story of that person drinking the night before, and then they would say once upon it, and they say, okay.
Yeah.
This is not a time.
Maybe.
You might see it coming. I mean, I'm always thinking, this thing I have learned from listening to computer scientists is always got to have in the back of your mind thinking computational scaling characteristics. How efficient is this thing? Right? And it, particularly with large language models, which require a huge amount of compute, right? Algorithmic scaling characteristics are the king, basically.
Right.
If you're getting dangerously close to saying, oh, well, if I had a sufficiently smart compiler, then I could do X, right? You know, I think you're doing the computer programming equivalent of overthinking it.
Yeah. Maybe we could just jump back into, just really quickly say, like, in detail, how you can get power loss scaling and things like parameters and data and so on under the assumptions of the model. It's very simple. This is not, like, super elegant. You have to, like, write down some, like, constants that you don't really have a good principled reason for them being maybe what they are or whatever. But if we imagine that we have this sequence of things that, like, models can learn and a probability distribution sort of over how frequently or power law distribution over how frequently each of those is useful for prediction, then if by learning one of the quanta, you can lower your loss on average by some amount delta on the samples where it's relevant. So, like, now that you have some piece of knowledge or computation, one of the quanta, you can lower your loss on some fraction of samples, well, then the mean loss will be lowered by delta times the frequency. If the frequencies follow a power law, then, like, the marginal improvement in your mean loss that you get from learning an additional one of these things follows a power law. And then basically integrating under that, you still get a power law. So if we have, like, we imagine some setup where we're writing the loss as a function of the number of the quanta that you've learned, then there's maybe some, like, initial loss of, like, not having learned anything, and then we're subtracting off, you know, some number of terms given by the number of quanta you learn, and basically just, you know, approximating this sum as an integral gives you a thing that looks like this, where we went from a exponent of minus alpha plus 1 to just minus alpha. This is the loss then as a function of the number of quanta that you learn. And then you can come up with stories about how having more parameters or having more data translates into learning more quanta. So for instance, if each quanta on average takes up some constant amount of capacity, then the number of quanta you can learn might be proportional then to the size of your network. And then you would have scaling, not in the little n, the number of quanta you learn, but in big N, the number of parameters, if little n is proportional to big N. Yep?
When you see you're like learning a quanta,
yeah.
Assume like they're all learned equally well.
Oh, yeah. I guess here we're just assuming that like you, it's an assumption of the model that things are like totally discrete, so they're either learned or not learned. Yeah. Whether this is like realistic is debatable. It's like seems to be realistic mostly for the toy task here, but then it's kind of a tricky question as to like whether there's actually an underlying discreteness to language models, which is like what I'll talk about a bit later. And you can come up with other stories, for instance, for data. So for instance, if for each one of these quanta, you needed some threshold number of examples which like use it, then like basically the number of quanta that you learn, if you have d samples in your data set, then like the number of samples involving a given quantum k is proportional to d times like the frequency that that's useful. So that also follows a power law. And then you can find that like the last one of these quanta that you learn is then, this quantity little n is then proportional to d to the 1 over alpha plus 1. So it's, again, a power law in d. And you can also come up with a story for scaling in time, where maybe you sort of learn the ones that are most frequent the fastest, because these allow you to lower the loss the most. And the magnitudes of the gradients are going to also follow a power law. That's not a very clean explanation, but basically, the amount that you're sort of incentivized to learn each one follows a power law, because the loss from reducing the amount you reduce your mean loss from learning each one follows a power law. So maybe the speed at which you'll learn it also follows a power law if like the strength of the gradients for learning each one follow a power law. This is a little bit tricky if maybe you're using some adaptive optimizer, where maybe the story is more about like variance rather than just the magnitudes of the gradients themselves. But it's one story you can come up with. So basically, the idea is just that we have this discrete set of things that we can learn. And if there's a power law with exponent alpha plus 1 governing how frequently each is useful to doing prediction, then like you can get scaling laws for things like the number of parameters, the number of data, the number of steps. And then these scaling exponents come from this power law exponent, right? So like much earlier when we talked about this like story of this smooth function approximation as like a model of neural scaling laws, the scaling exponent in that model is determined by the dimension of the input, or more broadly sort of like the dimension that the data lies on. And then here we're saying that you can also get power law scaling where the origin of that scaling law comes from not necessarily the dimension of the data, but because in our parity task, everything's really discrete. Maybe harder to imagine that data lying on a manifold, although maybe you can still come up with some story about that. But it seems to relate rather to the power law exponent. And the power laws in things like language like have been observed, because I think roughly there's this power law in like how frequently words are used. And so maybe that is like a result of a greater like underlying power law in like the processes that produce the text or something. But this is very speculative. And then just one caveat is that actually scaling in the sparse parity task seems a little bit more complicated than what the model says. So here I'm actually showing these are results of training lots and lots of different networks at different sizes. For different number of steps on different amounts of training data with a different power law exponent in the distribution over subtasks. And then we can then study, like, well, how does the empirical scaling law relate to the power law exponent in the subtask distribution? And we see that, like, it's not exactly what we would expect from theory. So, like, I don't really know what's going on here, I don't know. It seems like increasing. We're here. This is the alpha in the parallel distribution over subtasks, and then here's the empirical scaling exponent for number of parameters. And fortunately, it's increasing. It's just not maybe always exactly on this line. Scaling in steps, it seems to always be steeper, although it's actually kind of tricky to know exactly where you should measure the power law on these curves, because it seems like it kind of levels off. And then maybe that's why things seem to be higher, because I was only measuring from like here to here. And then data seems also like weirdly kind of insensitive to the scaling, rather the alpha and the data distribution at low alpha. I'm not sure what's going on here either. Yeah.
Have you tried any other fitting functions besides the power law? Eyeballing the middle graph on the left-hand column, my guess would be sigmoid. Try that first.
Yeah.
Have you tried that? See whether that gives you a better fit?
I have not. These look pretty clean for data.
Yeah.
But
structure, it starts more or less horizontal-ish.
Yeah.
Then squids and then levels out again at the bottom, and that says sigmoid.
Yeah. Yeah, I should try fitting other things. Yeah?
Sorry, so steps here meant like epochs with data fixed?
Oh yeah. So yeah, there's kind of two different types of data scaling here. And like when I talk about scaling in steps, that is in a setting where each batch I like re-sample it randomly. So like there's not a fixed training set size. It's like sort of training on infinite data. And then here I'm doing training over like multi-epoch training over a small data set size, or you know, over different data set sizes, and then doing early stopping. So basically I just look at like the loss at its lowest point, the test loss at its lowest point during the run.
And then like in both of the bottom plots, when you fix the parameter set?
Ooh, good question. I think for each of these, I was looking at like the biggest, roughly the biggest network in like this kind of range. So it was like, it was high hundreds or low thousands of hidden neurons, I think.
Because like if you don't, like the power law has to fail if you don't have sufficient parameters. Like eventually you're gonna forget, right? There's gonna be like catastrophic, you gotta repurpose neurons.
Yeah, I think maybe what instead happens is that like it just doesn't learn any more subtasks.
Oh sure.
Yeah. So like it'll still like do the optimal thing of like learning the most important ones, and then it'll just never learn the yeah.
So like I'm curious if the steps thing would like straighten out if you gave it like a massive number of parameters.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
I riff off what he just said, and because I'm listening to him, I think I might have an explanation for the apparent sigmoid behavior. I think it might be a finite size effect. Like we see this in ecosystems, it will sort of expand, like a species would expand, and then they saturate the environment and then they level off. Right? And so in the asymptotic infinite size, they're meeting my orbit of power law. Right? But the sigmoid-ish looking behavior there might be finite size effect, and the mechanism that
he
just outlined
might
be writing it.
Yeah. I wonder, there could also be other effects even on something like this, where like for each of these runs, I trained for a fairly long time, but possibly not enough time to like for the network to fully converge, and also the same amount of steps for each one. But then like with this power law, if it's a really, I guess, a high alpha, or alpha plus one in this scale, then the less frequent subtasks are really less frequent, and then it might take a really long time to train. And so it's possible that I had like not trained on convergence on these, and that's why there's some weirdness in like the deviation from the theory, because I like, just basically was not training these to like fully saturate the capacity of the network.
When can you say so this is so far away from the theory that the theory is wrong? Like, when would you let the ball lie in the sand?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I feel like the least confident maybe about the data scaling, because this just looks very clean and wrong at low alpha.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not sure. I guess that is a little bit of a problem for the theory if it's like there aren't clean bounds of like you could just, yeah.
Whenever I see a plot, I will always look at like where are the error bars, and the error bar is like a. I know it's not like a practical thing here, but still, I'm thinking like where.
I should have done it for this. So for each size, I did a few different runs at different seeds. So I should have had error bars on this plot. I think I could have done that. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe. I mean, is it possible that if you've done that like from many different runs, then your error bars are covering like the theory as well? Practically, you see one dot, but the error bars are so big that they're kind of covering that.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
And maybe for some reason, your errors are greater when your alpha is smaller.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that seems possible. It is a little bit expensive. So I think like doing this was at least 1,000 GPU hours. So it's a little bit tricky to run a lot of experiments. Yeah. But I could have even done it, I think, with this plot, and I just didn't. Although I think I had two or maybe three at each scale. Yeah. Okay, how much time do we have?
Maybe 10 more minutes, and then people would just go downstairs for the social that we have.
Okay. Oh yeah, there's a clock.
It started late, so yeah. And there were tons of questions, so yeah.
Okay, yeah, so we haven't actually talked at all about large language models, so let's just really quickly go through the data on like whether this kind of story might at all be what's going on with language models. So what I'm showing here is distributions over the loss. So we know that there's a power law in the mean loss, but how does the distribution over loss values across all the data change with scale? So here I'm showing the probability density of the loss. So here we see that very low losses are like by far the most common. This is maybe not surprising because the loss is lower bounded by zero, so of course things are going to accumulate near zero. But we see that the model, like for different sizes of model, here I had access to just like a half dozen language models of different size, trained on each a lot of data and the same data. So here we're just looking at parameter scaling for language models. And we see that the biggest model gets approximately zero loss on like, you know, more often than smaller models. Maybe unsurprising, here's what the loss times density of loss looks like. So integrating under this curve gives us the mean loss. And we see that the effect of scaling up the network is basically high loss is less common. This is kind of moving down here. I'm actually not sure what this like functional form is. It might be good to know that. Also, I show that with data. In the parity task, in the multitask sparse parity task, the distribution over losses is bimodal. It's like either one or zero. But language is much more complex. One thing you can also do is you can look at scaling on individual tokens. So you can look at, like, within some document, you can look at a particular token and ask how different size models do in predicting that token from its context. And the overall power law in the mean loss is basically averaging over, like, you know, if you were looking at 10 million tokens, it's averaging over 10 million scaling laws on individual tokens. We can visualize what these scaling laws on individual tokens look like. We see just a range of behaviors. You can find tokens where it looks like super smooth, where the model is getting a little bit better at predicting it at every scale. You can also find tokens where there seems to be a kind of discreteness, where here it's like continuing someone's name. It's maybe hard to make partial progress unless you really know the name. And at a particular scale, the model knows who that person is and predicts their like last name correctly. This is also a fact. It's about where someone works. And this person's like a financial analyst who shows up on financial news sometimes. And that's also this kind of discrete jump. You have to be a little bit careful, though. because that is only looking at one seed for the language models. So we only have one model at each scale. It's possible that randomness in the seeds is giving this kind of illusion of discreteness, where like if you had an underlying power law and then you just like added noise at each scale, then you might be able to find out of a large number of curves things that looked like plateau and then drop, just because like the noise made it look like that, and like it's just hard to study at large scale whether that's going on here. In our kind of model, like if we assume that there is this underlying discreteness, then the way you would have to explain partial progress, ignoring randomness from the seed, is that like maybe the model's ability to do prediction on tokens like this is like slightly influenced by like a large number of quanta which arise at different scales, and then things which look discrete, your ability to do prediction there is like really specific to like a particular quantum which is learned at a particular scale. So we have this taxonomy. We kind of borrow some terminology from genetics. Some traits, you know, maybe depend on like a single gene. These are monogenic traits. Other traits result of like a contributions from a large number of genes. So we can also then talk about whether the model's behavior on, you know, in some context is a result of like a single thing in the model or many things in the model contributing slightly to that behavior. But this is just looking at the behavior of the model, or like the scaling of the model. Whenever I see like a curve like this, like this would just be the way to interpret gradual progress, like under the theory. But I don't actually know that, like, oh yeah, here are the 10 modules in the network that are influencing, you know, the network's behavior on this token, and here's like why they appear at different scales, and so. Anyway. Then lastly, like, can we actually discover these things? Or like, can we figure out what some of the quanta might be in language modeling? So we do this kind of very preliminary simple thing, which is that we look at the model's gradients across predicting a large number of tokens, which the model is good at predicting. We take a large number of tokens across documents, which the model gets low loss on. And we compute the model's gradient in predicting that token, measured by the loss, so the gradient with respect to the loss. Or the gradient of the loss with respect to the model parameters. So we get basically a large number of very high-dimensional vectors. And then we try to do clustering. So basically find samples, tokens, where the model's loss in predicting that token, or the model's gradient in predicting that token points in similar directions for each cluster. And you get interesting clusters. So for instance, one thing that small language models are good at, like small large language models are good at, is continuing numerical sequences. So here what I'm doing is I'm highlighting the token that was predicted from its context. And here it's like, oh yeah, the model correctly predicted 07 in this list of numbers correctly. And then here it's predicting 4 in this 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8, and 5, and hexadecimal 0F. So there's maybe a like module in the network, one of these quantum, which like enables this skill of the model to continue sequences. We can also find other things which are really cool. I love this one, which is all the elements in this cluster involve predicting a new line to maintain the width of the text. So like a lot of text on the internet, or at least text in the data sets that these language models are trained on, is like OCR'd legal documents and this kind of thing, where there are like periodic line breaks to maintain roughly like the width of the text. And so like one of the things that the small language models do is they like figure out how to predict the new lines by like figuring out how long the previous lines were and then predicting the new line to maintain that width. You can actually do some follow-up work here. So these were all just like discovered automatically by our method by looking across tokens on the internet. But like here, you know, you can input some of your own text, and then like as you extend the line lengths beyond the length of the previous one, here the color of the token represents the probability that the model assigned that token as a new line. So we see that as I extend the length of the line beyond the cutoff of the previous lines, it like really wants that token to be a new line. So it's predicting that that token, given the context, is very likely to be a new line. So it seems like this is like a thing that the models like actually know how to do, is like count the line lengths and so on. So anyway, you can think about maybe each of these behaviors that we discover with the clustering as you know, corresponding to some module in the network, some algorithm that has been learned by the network to do that skill. And then just like our vision for thinking about the language models is just that there are a large number of these algorithms which implement different skills. And the effective scaling would be to learn algorithms which enable the network to do prediction on more and more niche contexts. We can also just look at like how large each of these clusters are. And maybe very roughly and messily, it's kind of a power law. But there are problems with like it's possible like kind of finite size things where we're going very quickly through this, so it might not make a lot of sense. Basically, you can just do this clustering for different numbers of clusters. The clustering algorithm we use, spectral clustering, like we need to like ahead of time give the algorithm some number of clusters that it's supposed to like cluster each of these samples into, and then we can just look at like the size of each of these clusters, see like the cluster size against like the index of the cluster when we sort them according to the size. And anyway, this is messy, but like maybe it's roughly a power law. And we would have expected the power law slope, given the empirical scaling exponent of the language models, to be something like this. Because the scaling exponent with respect to parameters is like minus 0.083. So we would expect the power law to be 1 minus 0.083. And that's the black line. And a better fit in this range from 100 to 1,000 is a little bit steeper than that. And we have some discussion in the paper of why that might be the case. But also, this is just like I can't claim that this method of discovering the quanta based on clustering with the gradients is like actually picking up on like the true underlying things that we should think about as being the quanta or something in the language models. So overall, it's like hard to be principled here. But I mostly just like kind of the behavior that we find, because like from an interpretability standpoint, if you're going to go and try and understand the model, you might be able to apply something like this to discover all the skills of the model and then look for explanations within the model of how each skill is being implemented. Okay, maybe just lastly, in deep learning in general, it's kind of an interesting situation, right? Because like we can engineer the systems really well. We understand at this like microscopic level exactly how they work, right? Because we implement the optimizers ourselves. We have access to the full state of the network at all time during training. But like this level of description of the systems feels like not the kind of thing that gives us a lot of information about the things that we care about. There is also like, so that's the microphysics, which we sort of already know. And then we sort of observe empirically these like macroscopic trends, like the scaling laws. It's like in thermodynamics, you know, like increase the volume and you decrease the pressure. That's a power law with exponent minus one. And here, like increase the compute and decrease the loss. So we sort of have this kind of perfectly understood microphysics, and then this sort of empirically understood like macroscopic physics. And you just might wonder in general, like what could exist in the middle and how you could maybe go from one to the other. And if we're right that like you can think about decomposing these large models into a bunch of modules, then that could be a nice, you know, what we would call quanta, could be a nice kind of middle scale where like any individual module, you know, quanta in the network, you know, consists of some number of parameters. You could study how it emerges over training, and then understand the macroscopic like performance of the network as being a result of like how many of these middle scale quanta that you learn. So that was kind of some of the inspiration also for doing this. Thank you.
Thanks a great talk, and we have very little time, but if you guys want to ask Eric any questions, particularly people in the Zoom, if you want to unmute yourself and ask questions, please, this is the time.
Yeah.
So two things. One thing is, so this looks like a principle of correspondence for neural networks. I think that's why you probably use the word quanta. Like you're saying, you want to go from very small scales, quantum physics, to large scales, classical physics. Like, it's just like that analogy, right? Like you're doing kind of like you're going all Niels Bohr on neural networks.
Yeah, I don't know how much that analogy works.
It might work quite well, actually. You look at things called epistemic restriction models in foundations of quantum mechanics.
So epistemic restriction models?
Epistemic restriction models.
Okay.
Where it's not possible even in principle to know everything about the system. When you ask a question, there's a back reaction effect. It's a bit like the situation you have with a neural net when you're trying to look at something, you have to discard some information. And you can reproduce a surprisingly large amount of quantum mechanics just using that.
Interesting. Cool. Well, thanks so much for your questions. Sounds good.
So I had another question. I think this would be like a probably, I'm just asking like an open question. This is like a prequel to finding a way to extract algorithms from like those large language models and seeing exactly what kind of algorithms they're learning. Like, AKA quantas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're saying like quantas would be, each of those might be one algorithm.
Yeah.
Like a couple of them is an algorithm, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, like, I think the reason why my advisor Max liked the project was his overall goal right now is like, from a safety standpoint, can we like translate neural networks into code? And then he was like, oh yeah, well, this seems really hard with big models. Maybe like we're just going in totally the wrong direction. In training bigger and bigger models, it's like going to make it impossible for us to understand them mechanistically or translate them into code. And I was like, well, is that necessarily the case? And could there be stories of what's going on in the networks where you would be more optimistic about understanding even very large ones? And like one such story, I think, would be like if you could decompose them into modules. But then you would have to like sort of, I thought that like if you're just thinking about the nature of scaling as being like just doing this global function approximation thing where you just get better and better precision, then it's not really clear in that kind of story like what the objects of study within the network would be. It doesn't feel like a picture of the networks is like consisting of a bunch of algorithms, but just this generic like function, you know, interpolation on a manifold thing. And then it's like, well, it might be hard to translate that into an algorithm. Yeah. So it's nice that it's possible in principle for scaling laws to average over a bunch of these discrete algorithms being learned. But whether or not that's actually happening in language models is like unclear, and like it'd be nice if it was. Maybe also you could still have lots of partial progress and like there wouldn't be these phase transitions and like you could still decompose it into modules. But like there isn't like a super strong version of discreteness like maybe we conjectured here.
Okay, but also using your terminology, so if let's say the next step would be in a small, large language model, if you find all the quantas and actually you go and detect in the network where each of these quantas is being learned.
Yeah.
And let's say for a very small one,
uh-huh.
Then you say, okay, I exactly know what quantas have been learned, I exactly know what algorithms have been learned by this small, large language model.
Yeah.
And then the next step would be probably to automate that
in
some sort of way
.
So that some other like network can learn those algorithms. Like, oh, this guy has learned these four algorithms. And then maybe you can scale that to like bigger things and say, oh, now this large, large language model has learned these 1,500 algorithms.
Yeah, that would be the hope. One fun thing is that there was a paper which I saw, which was submitted to iClear this year, which described how networks do something, I think, related to this task of like continuing a sequence. So it's cool. Like, I don't know if they had actually like seen our stuff, but like with this more general, I mean, it could be more principled, but this general way of like discovering different skills, like it identified a skill that then like people could go in and do interpretability on, although they might have just like discovered the skill in other ways. And anyway, it's tricky potentially to actually then take the behavior and like figure out an algorithm like that the network is implementing to implement the behavior. But like that would be the dream. Yeah.
Are you able to give like a formal definition of tokenomics and the toy cases you like the binary string cases initially introduced?
I don't know it.
I assume that task is kind of wild. Like, you can either write down the functions.
Yeah, I guess so. It's possible that like the simplest way that you would implement the each subtask might be different from the way in practice the network implements the subtask, but I should do some more interpretability like actually on the neural networks which do the sparse parity task, or the multitask sparse parity task. But I don't really understand how they do it, or like what the quanta are mechanistically within the network.
But is there a way, if you can, like, don't look at the neural network, just look at data sets, like categorize how many possible quantas can be learned, something like that.
From the data?
From the data.
Yeah, although this might be just like the thing that the network has to figure out in the process of training. So like, I don't know if you could do it in a way that would be more efficient than training a network. But just in general, like, assuming that there is a decomposition, I would like to have better ways of actually doing the decomposition and being like, oh yeah, like this is how we should think about the network solving this task in terms of a bunch of modules. But in general, it seems like a hard problem.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Pfizer wanted to like test my creativity one time. So he gave me that like that question where it's like, think of 10 uses for a brick. Have you ever gotten that?
For a what?
For like a brick.
For
like
a brick.
Ways to use it.
Yeah.
And like you'd come up with like 10. But then like I told him I could put it on the table and I could put it on the table an inch to the right.
Yeah.
I could put it on the table 2 inches to the right.
Yeah.
And I got up to 10 inches.
Yeah.
And he said I wasn't very creative. And what I guess what I'm getting at is like, is that one subtask that I just described or 10? Because with the multi-parity sort of thing, it almost feels like there's only one subtask, which is a control system with like a vocabulary of 1 to 500,
yeah,
and then a single target function. But then if you decide to break it into lower granularity, you end up with 500 subtasks, or maybe even more if you say you only have to like perform the parity on bits that are like zeroed out on the like end. So it's like, how do you actually pick the granularity to look for these dynamics?
How do you define a quanta, I think?
Yeah.
Because there's kind of a continuum of like every little thing you could do in language could be a subtask, and there's like, you know, a Tower of Babel worth of them.
Yeah. So there are kind of, so like in interpretability in the networks, there are like other words that people use where it's like, oh yeah, like we want to like enumerate the features or like enumerate the circuits or something in the model. There's this kind of issue in neuroscience, as I understand it, of like, well, like what is the right like level of coarse graining to understand the system? You have like neurons and groups of neurons and groups of neurons. And it seems like maybe there's something here where you can talk about features and you can talk about circuits in the network and so on. But hopefully there's like some level of analysis where like the dynamics of the system kind of like snap into place and like feel clearest. And then we would maybe call those like the quanta. But it's tricky in general.